On this week's program, we listen back to interviews with author Steve Lopez and conductor Michael Tilson Thomas. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Lantern Theatre Company as it stages a new adaptation of the classic Nikolai Gogol play, The Government Inspector. And Susan Lewis considers the history of Philadelphia's Settlement Music School and the many lives it has touched in its now 100-year history. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Michael Tilson Thomas is music director of the San Francisco Symphony and the founder and artistic director of the New World Symphony in Miami. He's also the principal guest conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra. Over the course of his now almost 40-year career, Tilson Thomas has conducted many of the world's greatest orchestras. He was recently in town to lead the Philadelphia Orchestra, and when we met backstage at the Kimmel Center, I first asked him how he saw his role when guest conducting an orchestra.
The way I think of myself as a conductor is a little bit in the role of director slash coach, something like this. And what a director does, a director works with different casts of people who are great. They are great people. They have amazing abilities. And the director tries to give them some possibilities of using their essentially great qualities to still perhaps greater advantage, more effective advantage. Because when people are in the midst of the ensemble situation, they, in their absorption of doing all they have to do, perhaps don't see that they really should be taking a little bit more time over here, or perhaps they should be giving one of their colleagues a little bit more room there, and, you know, that their roles of variously supporting one another or challenging one another or whatever it may be could be perhaps pointed up a bit more, which would give a more exciting shape to the entire proceedings and at the same time would be most essentially about the incredible communicative talent of those people who are actually giving the performance.
And you mentioned the word communicate. How do you communicate, or how do you learn how to communicate with a group of 100-plus musicians in the short space of time that you're going to spend with them?
Well, at this point in my life, I just kind of go for it. I just do it. You know, I just start talking about certain specific situations which relate to timing and rhythm and breathing, and certain things relate to tone quality. And a thing that I like to do very much is that the orchestra contains people who have great careers as soloists and chamber musicians, and sometimes by referring them to music which they know from that other world, it can cause them to think about it differently and perhaps bring more personal qualities that they might be associating with that part of their lives more into what can happen in the orchestra.
And you talk about it being different casts, the Philadelphia Orchestra being your Philadelphia cast. Mm-hmm. You're in London, you're the principal guest conductor there. Does your approach vary with the cast that's put in front of you?
Yes.
How so?
Because I have certain ideals of what the piece in its totality should be about. And with different ensembles, they have natural instincts which make different parts of that design instantly clear. So that I might hear in one orchestra that they have an astounding rhythmic organization, and another one that have amazing tonal lushness, and another one that has great variety of idiosyncratic wind players or whatever it might be, and also that the hall allows various things. So I'm saying, okay, well, all these things are already in focus. Maybe we can do more with some of these other qualities over here, or perhaps if I, you know, suddenly realize that there's an astoundingly powerful and organized double bass section, say, well, aha, we can really make the bass line still a more dramatic part of the proceedings because the talents and strengths of the section suggest that that might be possible.
And then I'm working with your other two, your day jobs, so to speak, in San Francisco and in Miami. Clearly very different approaches there. In San Francisco, a group of very well-established musicians, in the New World Symphony, younger players. Mm-hmm. Clearly, in San Francisco, you have years of working with them and you have, you know, formed them in your own likeness, so to speak. With the New World, it's an ever-changing cast. It's younger musicians. How is the approach in those two different situations?
Well, San Francisco is, of course, very accustomed to the particular things that I tend to ask for, which are usually more extreme than what many of my colleagues may ask for. A lot of conductors do enjoy kind of organizing things and establishing certain limits on things. It's generally my nature to do the opposite. I'm trying to encourage people to kind of color outside the lines and figure out ways in which they could be more soloistic. They could take more chances. In an orchestra, as I've said many times, is a large ensemble of people, and generally in a large number of people, we all try and find some middle ground. We're told that in society and in life, that's good. We find some middle ground on which we can agree, and that's kind of consensus. Well, that, they say, works well in society. Doesn't actually work so well in an orchestra, because then everything is kind of mezzo piano, mezzo forte, not too short, not too long. And the whole idea of what you need to do is to encourage people to go to various kinds of extremes at particular moments. And in the case of something like a Mahler symphony, it means that somebody might have to be playing the most legato tender music while somebody else is just barking or baying at the moon in a quite outrageous fashion. And those elements must coexist with one another because the music is representing different streams of thought or different ideas in the world, as Mahler claimed it did.
And you must be communicating both of those ideas simultaneously.
Yes, and also I'm clear at establishing for the orchestra that there are different levels of expression simultaneously occurring, and which is the level in which they at this moment find themselves, and also that there are particular moments in which the whole drama of the piece hinges on what one second clarinetist may do, and that he understands that that is his big moment and that everyone's relying upon him to do something completely out of the box.
Michael Tilson Thomas. He was recently in Philadelphia to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra in Aaron Copland's Symphony for Organ and Orchestra with soloist Paul Jacobs and Mahler's Symphony No. 5.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia's Settlement Music School has been giving music lessons for 100 years. As part of its centennial celebration, the school has selected 100 past and present students, faculty, and others to honor. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the history, the people, and the impact of this 100-year-old community resource.
For some kids, Saturdays might mean a chance to get outside and hit baseballs. Or perhaps shoot some hoops with the dog. But there are also a bunch of kids who flock indoors. Settlement Music School on Saturdays is filled with the sounds of music. And kids.
I take ballet, violin, and I go to music workshop.
The piano, and I play recorder, drums, and that's all.
I play in a quartet with a piano, cello, violin, and viola.
These 21st century music students are joining the ranks of over 300,000 people who've learned and played at Settlement Music School. In the early 20th century, the Settlement House providing services to immigrants in the South Wark section of Philadelphia also included music lessons. Current executive director Robert Capanna, who's been with the school over 30 years, says the essence of the program hasn't changed all that much since those very early days.
The only thing that we don't do that was originally done is that we no longer give baths and sewing classes and English lessons.
Okay, so the details may have changed a bit. Settlements also expanded, branching into other neighborhoods in and around Philadelphia. 5-cent piano lessons gave way to instruction in all musical instruments, taught by professional musicians, including members of the Philadelphia Orchestra. In 1914, Settlement became an independent music school, and in 1917 moved into what is still its main branch, the Mary Louise Curtis Building at 5th and Queen Streets. While its conservatory division became the nucleus of the Curtis Institute of Music in 1924, Settlement continued to offer instruction to all musical levels, from beginner to pre-professional. Former student Anne Hobson Pilot is now principal harpist of the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
I studied the harp with Edna Phillips, and she became, I guess you would call her, my mentor. Settlement Music School gave me a very good start.
Pilot is one of the 100 people Settlement has chosen to recognize during its centennial, and one of the many professionals who trace their musical beginnings to this community school. Conductor Mariana Paoni Gabi is another. The first American woman invited to conduct in China, Gabi was a young child when she came to Settlement to play the violin.
That was right after the war, and that meant that we had teachers from Europe. Because the director was from Europe, we had top-notch people teaching us. And of course, we didn't know it at the time. We were too busy finding out where we fit in the group, right? And what we were going to wear to the concert.
Dollar-a-week horn lessons in the late 1960s paid off for Joe Anderer, now principal horn at the Metropolitan Opera. But Anderer says he was truly smitten by the chamber music ensemble run by bassoonist Shirley Curtis, a love that followed him to New York City.
I tried for a long time to do as much chamber music as I possibly could, and I used to think of my freelancing in New York as being what I had to do to subsidize my quintet habit. But Shirley's the one that started all that.
Although its alumni play in major orchestras all over the country, Settlement, in selecting the 100 people to recognize for its centennial, was not going for the most accomplished in classical music, says Executive Director Bob Capanna, or even the most important contributors to the school. Instead, the goal was to show the variety of the lives Settlement has touched.
Many of whom had had remarkable achievements, but some of whom just had terrific stories and were interesting twists on how a life informed by music can turn out.
So the list includes a Nobel laureate, Pulitzer Prize and Academy Award winners, musicians, scientists, teachers, business people, philanthropists, writers, and actors. People distinguished as individuals, but also by the eclectic mosaic they create when considered together. There's writer Libby Harwitz.
When I was about 12 or 13, I went and I had the great privilege to study with the second violinist of the Budapest String Quartet, Edgar Ortenberg. I did chamber music and studied violin. I am not a gifted violinist. I had a lot of passion.
And Rick Marvin, film and television composer.
I studied with a wonderful teacher named Don Rappaport. I studied counterpoint and theory with him, and was the first time I actually studied classical music. Up to that point, I've been playing jazz and rock and pop, and it was a wonderful experience.
Settlement was, after all, a place filled with young people discovering music on stage and off.
I would go to lessons on Friday. The director at the time, he would give me tickets to the Philadelphia Orchestra.
All the students went, and when you came out of there, your neck was like, oh, my God, I'll never be able to straighten out because we were in the first row in the orchestra pit. But it was such a marvelous experience.
And studying music at Settlement wasn't about only, well, music.
It's Dr. Perchik says, don't pick your nose and pay attention. He was very nice. He was very strict, and he got right down to business.
A South Philadelphia kid named Chubby Checker took piano lessons and would go on to create a red-hot dance craze.
Come on, baby. Let's do the
little did I know back then that the things that I learned there, I'd be using in my music career far beyond my expectations.
And go like this.
This year's celebrations have triggered lots of memories. Settlement somehow managed to combine instruction, discipline, a connection to a larger musical world, and, says Michael Bacon, film composer and half of the Bacon Brothers band, a sense of fun.
A lot of my friends would go after school, and I remember one time I played drums in a wind ensemble, and that was my dream always to be a drummer. So Settlement to me always was a relaxed, fun place to be, which is what you really need to provide for children with music.
Michael's brother, actor Kevin Bacon, also one of the Settlement 100 honorees, suspects that if you scratch the surface, you'll find an enormous number of people enriched by music.
If I walk onto a movie set, at any given time, probably 25% of the people play something. oftentimes during lunch or after work will start to pull out instruments left and right.
Another major player in the film world, Irvin Kershner, who directed the blockbuster The Empire Strikes Back, says his violin, viola, and composition studies at Settlement informed his highly successful movie career.
Rhythm, music, was very important. To me, always been the basis of a good film was a film that was rhythmically sound, a film that was like a piece of music.
And it's this idea that continues to drive Settlement Music School, that music can enhance everyone's life. Lawyer Beth Haas, who studied piano as a child, is a passionate advocate for Settlement, founding and co-chairing the Young Friends Committee to cultivate the next generation of donors to the arts.
When you talk to the musicians, particularly the young musicians, and you realize how playing an instrument, whether or not they're going on to professional careers, has changed their lives. That is what has inspired me and my husband to become very, very much involved in the school.
And so Settlement presses on, reaching out to everyone in the community, from the youngest, with its Kaleidoscope preschool program, to seniors up into their 90s, who play everything from strings to trumpet to chamber ensembles. But the proof of the passion is the music in the air, wafting from the windows, even on a sunny Saturday in the spring.
My goal is to reach the top and to be a good person and to play piano and teach my kids how to do it.
It's given me so many great opportunities to play all sorts of different types of music, and it's been great. Very fun. I wouldn't spend my Saturday anywhere else.
Settlement Music School students ending that report by WRTI's Susan Lewis. The final event in the school's centennial year celebrations is a live concert broadcast on WRTI on December 7th from the Grand Ballroom of the Park Hyatt at the Bellevue. It will be hosted by WRTI's Dave Conant and Settlement's Robert Capanna. The program will feature students and alumni in performance. In 2005, on a busy street corner in downtown L.A., former Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Steve Lopez heard a beautiful melody being drawn from a battered violin by a shabbily dressed homeless man. Nathaniel Ayers had once been a promising musician, studying bass at Juilliard. Now destitute and suffering with mental illness, he was living on the streets. What started off as a series of columns for the L.A. Times turned into a mission for Lopez, and he has, over the past 3 years, formed a close friendship with Ayers that has taken the musician off the streets and into a more stable existence. Steve Lopez tells that story in his book, The Soloist, which is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia. We spoke with him earlier this year.
Downtown Los Angeles is a very busy place. It's thousands of people walking to and from work. And he did not appear to be playing for money. He didn't have the violin case open. He didn't have a hat out. He was just playing to play music. And I said, well, why do you pick this particular spot? And he pointed across the street and he said, there's the Beethoven statue. I play here for inspiration. And so then I knew I might have something, but it took several visits to figure out what this guy's story was. And with each visit, he warmed up to me a little more, and I was able to tug the story out of him. And the big break comes when he's scratching names on the sidewalk, and I ask him, who's Betty and Albert and Tom and, you know, Rebecca, and he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. And I said, Nathaniel, you went to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts? He said, oh, yeah, that was a while back. He said it quite nonchalantly, like it's no big deal to go to Juilliard. And I'm thinking, okay, we've got an African-American man, homeless, playing a violin, missing two strings, went to Juilliard. I think I've got a column.
Nathaniel, at this point, wouldn't have appeared to have been a very, shall we say, reliable source. How did you go about verifying this story?
Well, you know, I would ask Nathaniel on the street there, who can I talk to get the backstory on this? And how did you train in Cleveland? How did you become a musician? And he said, well, you know, I grew up it was kind of a tough neighborhood. His mother had a beauty salon. His dad was out of the picture. Mom had music on in the beauty salon. And Nathaniel just took to the music. He'd go there after school. The ladies are all having their hair done. And Nathaniel's enjoying the music. And his mother says, maybe you should take piano lessons. So he does a couple years of that and then goes to junior high band. And that's, you know, we're talking 60s when public schools in America had extensive arts programs. It was considered part of a well-rounded education and everybody was handed an instrument. And the arts were big. It was before we got into the three R's and not much else. So he had a natural thing for it, and his junior high band teacher had him playing several instruments, but nobody could play the bass. And Nathaniel was a strong kid, and they needed a rhythm section, and Nathaniel was pushed in the corner with the bass and became so good on it in such a hurry that his teacher, Mr. Moon, said, "I can't help you. You're going to have to go to see this guy in the Cleveland Symphony. His name is Harry Barnoff. He's been in the orchestra forever, and he teaches some of my better students." And that became his tutor. So I'm on the street in downtown L.A., and I said, "Nathaniel, who influenced you?" And he said, "Oh, you can call Mr. Harry Barnoff in Cleveland." And I said, "Well, how do I get hold of him?" And with an index finger, thin air, writes out his phone number. And I scribble it in my notebook, and I said, "Are you still in contact with him?" He said, "Nope, I haven't talked to him in decades." So I'm calling the number thinking it can't be any good. And somebody picks up on the other end and says, "Barnoff residence."
Wow.
So Harry Barnoff told me that Harry was in tears when I told him that his former student was playing a two-string violin in downtown Los Angeles living out of a shopping cart. And he said, "That was one of the most promising students I ever had, and my heart is broken hearing this. He was such a great kid, and it was so tragic to see his crash."
People, we love a great story about redemption, and this really is just such a story, is it not?
This is, I think it's a story about second chances and human connections and the power of art and music. It has saved him. In his third year at Juilliard, he starts getting very confused and having trouble focus, and when you go through the transcripts, if he's having to sit in a classroom and study the history of music literature, his grades are falling. If he's in performance with the orchestra, he's getting A's, and the teacher comments are, "Promising young talent, renew his scholarship, unlimited potential." Nobody knew that he was losing his mind, and Juilliard at the time, as far as I can gather, was not a welcoming place, and there was nobody there to pick up on little emotional problems or psychological problems. And there was one teacher there, a bass teacher by the name of Gary Carr, who went on to be the rare person with a solo career as a bassist, who saw that Nathaniel was having problems. And he told the administration, they said, "No, he's just a troublemaker." And he said, "No, he is losing his mind," which indeed he was. So he crashes, goes home to Cleveland. He's in and out of his mother's house. He's on the streets. He realizes he can't lug a bass around in a shopping cart. He saves up money working at Wendy's and shoveling snow, walks 15 miles, buys a violin, and has been trying to teach himself other instruments all these years later. So I meet him, and he's down and out. But, you know, this serendipitous encounter leads to what has been a really deep and meaningful three-year odyssey and one of the most meaningful relationships and friendships in my life.
Steve Lopez, the soloist, is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia, and a movie based on the book starring Robert Downey Jr. as Lopez and Jamie Foxx's Nathaniel Ayers will be released in March. The Lantern Theatre Company in Philadelphia celebrates its 15th anniversary season this year, and at the heart of the theatre's lineup is a play that's celebrating its 172nd anniversary. Over the years, The Government Inspector by Russian author Nikolai Gogol has undergone many revivals around the world and has been adapted for film, television and opera. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, The Lantern is offering its own new translation of this satirical play.
Nikolai Gogol is renowned in the world of Russian literature. The prose style of his novels and plays was groundbreaking in the early to mid-1800s. Setting the stage for other Russian fiction writers like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky.
Scholars would tell you that he is kind of the father of the Russian realism.
Armina Lamana, who was born and lived in the Soviet Union until she was 13, translated Gogol's Government Inspector for the Lantern Theater. Rather than use an existing English edition, the company wanted to start from the Russian original to get the most accurate sense of the playwright's vision. It took only about a month for Lamana to draft a new English version of the five-act comedy.
I did a verbatim translation. I did not change any of the idioms. It was me, dictionary, and the Russian version of the play.
The story, which Gogol wrote in 1836, centers on a small Russian village that's just learned of an impending undercover visit from a government inspector. The news throws the townspeople into a comical panic as they try to cover up the lies and corruption of the local province. Past productions of The Government Inspector typically used large numbers of actors to represent this community. But according to the play's director, David O'Connor, this wasn't an appealing approach for the Lantern Company.
Like many theaters in the country, many theaters in the world, it's difficult to afford a large cast, the cast that is, you know, that the show asks for in its original form. So we started to put together a vision that would allow it to happen with five actors. And what we tried to do is create a production where the five actors became a necessary, important part of the production, the fact that the cast was small and not just sort of an excuse.
Even though the play was written over 170 years ago in Russian, Armina Lamana says her word-for-word translation didn't require much alteration to make sense in English.
David pretty much told me that like 99% of the time he had no trouble understanding even the Russian versions of things. You know, in English you'll say somebody kicks the bucket. If you translate it to Russian, it doesn't mean the same thing, obviously. Most of the idioms that were in Russian that I just typed in Russian, David understood because they're pretty straightforward.
Lamana and O'Connor did work together, however, to condense the plot, removing peripheral characters and tightening up lengthy speeches. Altogether, about one-third of the play was cut. O'Connor says while Gogol was actually a concise writer for his time, the original version would feel long today.
Today's audience is able to absorb information much more quickly and are much more comfortable absorbing information visually, I would think. And so as such, they don't need as many words to get the point across. So if we did Gogol's play at full length, I think a lot of the passages would be repetitive and long and would not be necessary to get the same impact.
At the core of The Government Inspector are themes of corruption, facades, and deception, which play out in all aspects of the story, romance included.
It would be better if instead of poetry I spoke of my love, which from your gaze...
Love? I don't understand.
Why are you moving away? It would be better for us to be near each other.
Why so near? It's all the same apart.
Why apart? It's all the same so near.
Say that again.
Luigi Sotil and Sarah Sanford are two of the five actors that perform in the Lantern Theater's adaptation. Here they play Klestakov and Maria. In the view of Sanford, the satirical tale of a 19th-century Russian town trying to hide its deficiencies offers a look at pitfalls common everywhere.
They are so afraid of what might happen to them that by trying to patch up the town in this ineffective way, they lead themselves deeper and deeper into lies. And it makes the situation that much worse. It's like a freight train that has to crash eventually.
This type of storyline and humor, according to David O'Connor, is still in use today.
Like the classic structure of a modern-day sitcom. Sitcom begins, someone is caught lying, they spend the rest of the episode trying to cover it up until they've been called out on their lie.
O'Connor points out that the themes also remain relevant. Bribery, corruption, and incompetence can be found in institutions and government bureaucracies everywhere.
That's why I think, you know, all these kinds of plays are always worth revisiting, because we look and see that the people 150 years ago, you know, halfway around the world, are dealing with the exact same kinds of things that we're dealing with here and today.
With its new adaptation of The Government Inspector, the Lantern Theater reworked a classic tale to accommodate the limited resources of a small company. But while scaled down from the original version, the heart of Gogol's play remains intact and still resonates. And because, in truth, humans evolve ever so slowly, in another 172 years, this story will probably still resonate.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Government Inspector runs at the St. Stephen's Theatre in Philadelphia through December 28th. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.